This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's a couple of months before the Congress that was elected last Tuesday takes office here in Washington, but we already know at least some elements of the president's agenda, and we know he will have greater majorities in both the House and the Senate to help him enact them. The Republican total in the Senate is up from 51 to 55. That, though, does not translate to 100% control. Senate rules require 60 votes on most controversial issues, and neither party, as a practical matter, votes as a bloc. Moderate Republicans and conservative Democrats often cross the aisle. The rules in the House of Representatives allow for a simple rule by majority, and the Republican leadership controls the entire process. They can almost always schedule votes when they know they can win and block them if they have any doubts. How long will the president's honeymoon last? Taxes, Social Security, budgets, deficits, cultural issues, and the courts. We'll speak with two current senators in a few minutes, and of course, we want to hear from you. If you're a partisan on either side, which issues are paramount? If you're a centrist, how and where do you bridge the divide? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor. Always good to see you, Ron.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And lay out for Ron how things finally wound up in the Senate. As we mentioned, 55 to the Republicans now have a substantial majority in the Senate. What about the House of Representatives?
The House of Representatives, as you mentioned, operates by simple majority, and they have a majority. They've got 231 seats. They may get up as high as 233, depending on how a couple of runoffs down in Louisiana go in December. But all they need for a majority is 218. And if they had a solid 218 and they could hold all 218 on every vote, they really wouldn't need any more. That's how the House operates. And they can also make the rules as they go along. They can decide what is germane, what can be brought to the floor, what amendments will be in order. So they can run a pretty tight ship with 218, and I think that's exactly what they plan to do. All the leadership will be the same. Not many changes in the committees. Only one big committee chairmanship is changing for sure at appropriations. So this will be the familiar gang, and they know where they want to go.
And just to explain it to people, there are committees that are very important in both houses of Congress. They are set up proportionally to the overall structure. So Republicans obviously chair every single committee in both the House and the Senate.
That's correct. And in the House, the majority, again, permits some supermajorities on some of the most important committees, the money committees, so that it's not just reflective of the ratio of members, Democratic and Republican overall, but there is some stacking in there to make sure that the Ways and Means Committee, for example, is controlled by the majority party. That's been done by both parties when they were in control. Over on the Senate side, this big jump from 51 up to 55 may not seem big on the surface, but it has a lot of meaning. Among other things, it means that instead of one vote majority on each Senate committee, the Republicans will now have two. And so one maverick Republican on a given committee will not be enough to empower the Democrats.
And so as we go along there, one thing that will be different on a couple of both houses, really, is, well, every election you lose some famous characters, and you get some who you first look at, you get them, they may be famous soon.
Well, and of course, in the case of this Senate election, we are going to be bringing Tom Coburn from Oklahoma into the Senate. He served 6 years in the House back in the 1990s, and he drove his own Republican leaders there in the House to distraction because he was very good at forcing issues to the floor that the leadership would just as soon not have to deal with. He was always bringing up amendments and doing other things that discomfited the Republican leadership. That in a chamber where the rules are very much in favor of the leadership and the majority. When you bring him over to the Senate, where there are functionally no rules in many instances, where he can bring things up whenever he feels like it, where he can bring the regular order to a halt whenever he wants to, I think Tom Coburn is going to get famous pretty quickly.
And he will have another freshman, this one from South Carolina, who is ideologically compatible.
Jim DeMint, as a matter of fact, also a former member of the House. These are members of the Republican movement from the early 1990s that was very strong and conservative on economic issues, but particularly wanted to raise the salience of the social conservative agenda. Tom Coburn, himself a physician, has said that he believes that doctors who perform abortions should be subject to the death penalty like anyone else who takes a human life in a homicide. That kind of thing is not typically heard in the debates of the Senate, but Tom Coburn is going to change that tone.
And as we look at the parties in general, is it fair to say that the Republicans are more conservative than they used to be, the Democrats more liberal than they used to be?
Yes, because the kind of Republican who's getting elected in the southern states that are electing more Republicans, and the South has 26 Senate seats, 22 of them are now held by Republicans, and the kind of Republican who's winning those seats tends in the direction of the most conservative. Not always. The new Republican from Georgia, Johnny Isaacson, would be more in the moderate mold, but most of them tend to be more conservative than either the Republican or the old-fashioned Southern Democratic conservative ever were. So that's one influence. Another influence is that the old moderate Democrats, many of them from the South, are retiring and disappearing. So we don't have a John Breaux. We don't have a Zell Miller. We don't have a Bob Graham. And that particular lane in the Senate is being left empty.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we look at the issues, obviously, as you say, in the House of Representatives, the Republican leadership should be able to pretty much work its will. This does not always apply in the Senate, which, as you point out, the rules are more flexible. And the most important rule that everybody knows about now is the, I guess, cloture is the most famous inside baseball term that people know. It's the 60 votes or 60% of those voting you need to stop a debate, stop a filibuster, in effect, pass any controversial measure.
That's correct. And since they're at 55, they need 5 Democrats to get to 60. Are there 5 Democrats they can get? Well, on tax policy, they could possibly go to Max Baucus of Montana. On some issues, they could go to Ben Nelson of Nebraska. On some other issues, maybe Bill Nelson of Florida. But it's difficult to count on, across the board, any of the members of the Democratic minority in the way that they used to be able to count on, say, a Zell Miller. So it may be tough getting to those 5, particularly because the Republicans, on many issues, will not be able to count on all 55 of their own. They've got, for example, the 2 women senators from Maine, Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe, who tend to be moderate to liberal on some social questions, and several other Republicans as well. Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, who frequently voted for the Democrats in the last Congress, has even said that he did not plan to vote for George Bush for president, and that he could imagine himself someday changing parties and being a Democrat.
Our number, if you'd like to join our conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking about the next Congress, what issues are likely to come up, and how the increased Republican majorities in both houses of Congress is likely to affect our politics. Our guest is Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor. Let's talk with Eric, who joins us on the line from San Francisco.
Hi, I'm fascinated by what you're saying, and to the extent that guys like Tom Coburn think that doctors who perform abortions should be subject to the death penalty, that Arlen Specter's comment about being more circumspect about the kinds of judges that might get through the Senate Judiciary Committee, and then this morning I read something about in both Wisconsin and Georgia, creationism being taught next to evolution as a serious subject in a science class. How will more moderate Republicans experience their own identity now that they have to obligate themselves to this, I think even by their own understanding of themselves, extremely conservative group of people that have been led into the tent and really were responsible for putting the Republican Party in the position that it's in now?
Mm-hmm. Ron?
Well, at one extreme, they could decide that their party wants them to go another way and change their views. At another extreme, they could decide they'd be more comfortable in the Democratic Party. I don't expect that we'll see much of either of those extremes. I think most of the moderate Republicans, as we call them, will choose to pick and choose one issue at a time, be with the leadership when they can be, go with their own political impulses and their own political pressures and influences when that serves their purpose, which would, of course, I suspect, be most of the time. You mentioned Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania, a longtime champion of abortion rights. He is now ascending by right, by seniority, to be chairman of the Judiciary Committee, which considers the president's nominees for federal bench jobs. That includes the district courts, the appellate courts, and, of course, the Supreme Court. Arlen Specter has been waiting for this job for a long time, and he's rotated up to it now. But because of his remark concerning the president not sending up anybody who was too hardline on abortion, that's kicked off a firestorm already in the Senate, and a lot of people outside the Senate saying that they would be extremely angry to see Arlen Specter take that chairmanship. And there will be a challenge, and there will be some debate within the Senate's Republican ranks over whether or not he will actually get to do that job.
Eric, thanks for the call.
Thanks very much.
There are any number of other issues. Obviously, abortion rights is going to be a major controversy, particularly in the context of the Supreme Court nominations. But in general, the effort by those who are call themselves pro-life has been to restrict abortion around the edges, parental consent, partial birth abortion were the big issues. Are they going to be moving from those kinds of issues to issues towards banning abortion, except in some circumstances?
Eventually, they would like to do that. I'm not sure they see that as part of the agenda for the 109th Congress. I think they would like to continue the incremental strategy of restricting and restricting and restricting to the point where, for example, we would ban all second trimester abortions as well as all third trimester abortions and just ratchet the limitations down to the point where abortions became rare.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Gil, who's with us from Bishop, California.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I'd like to urge everybody to go to Greg Palast website, GregPalast.com. I don't think the American people are getting the truth about the vote.
In what respect, Gil?
That the media is not covering this topic. Greg Palast broke the story on the vote in 2000, how the blacks were disenfranchised. I don't hear anybody on the media addressing this subject. It's GregPalast.com.
Thanks for the call, Greg. We're not speaking with Mr. Palast, as far as I know, but we are speaking with two people later in the program about who voted and how various voting techniques worked and about what he may be referring to obliquely, and that is allegations that somehow the votes were stolen or hacked. And we'll be asking our guests about whether that might have happened, could have happened, and indeed whether it did happen. I guess if it did, we would have led with it. But anyway, let's talk about that later in the program and get another caller on the line. Sandy is with us. Sandy's calling from Trapper Creek, Alaska.
Yeah, considering the supply and demand of natural gas and the cost, how high on the priority list is putting a natural gas pipeline from the top of Alaska down to the bottom? Because, you know, a lot of people base their vote on whether or not we'd be getting a natural gas line through. And
a big issue, Sandy, in Alaska and elsewhere, Ron Elving.
Absolutely, yeah. And we've had a package of energy policy changes that's been bumping around in Congress now for a better part of a decade, really, and came awfully close to being passed in the last Congress, did get through the House, did get through the Senate, but got hung up on some very small, relatively speaking, issues, and that has therefore died with this Congress, will die as this Congress officially comes to an end. This will be another thing that the president pushes very hard in the new year, and which he expects this new Senate and House majority to be sufficient to pass.
And let me ask another question that Sandy and others in Alaska may be interested in. The brief time we have available, and Sandy, thanks for the phone call, Ron Elving, and that is drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This has been blocked by the Senate primarily over past years. Is that changed enough that drilling for oil in that area will get underway, do you think?
Well, the votes that would support the filibuster are primarily still there. And we were never close to 60 votes to overcome the filibuster, to invoke cloture and end a filibuster and make the drilling begin. We've never really been close to 60 there. I don't think we're close to 60 now. But what could happen would be at some juncture a large compromise on a number of energy issues that might include that.
Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor, thank you so much for joining us here in Studio 3A.
My pleasure, Neil.
When we come back from a break, Patrick Leahy will join us as we talk with members of the next Senate. This is Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our subject is the next Congress, which takes office come January. Of course, you're invited to join us. The number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. What issues do you want to see addressed in the next Congress? And if it's an issue of compromise, which party do you think is now obliged to come across the aisle and offer a hand of reconciliation? Joining us now from Capitol Hill is Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, senior Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And Senator Leahy, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
It's good to be with you.
And let me ask you an overall question in general. When you're in the minority, do you get a chance to propose items, bills, or is it simply a matter of, for the most part, playing defense?
Well, it can be a little bit of both. Since I've been in the Senate, I've been three or four times in the majority, three or four times in the minority. And when I've been in the minority, I've been able to still pass legislation of my own, did during this past session. But the agenda can still be set by the majority and usually is. In this case, it's a double-edged sword for the Bush administration because they control the White House, the House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, some would say the U.S. Supreme Court, so that they're really in a case where they have to take full responsibility. I would hope that they would reach out and carry out that responsibility because they have some enormous problems up ahead. I think in the next week, there's going to have to be a vote on raising the federal debt limit. It's around $7 trillion now. We hadn't had to do that for years because, as you know, the huge surpluses during the Clinton administration. Now with the huge deficits during the Bush administration, they're going to have to vote to raise the debt limit. And the question
just in terms of gamesmanship, and in previous years when Democratic administrations needed to raise the debt limit, the Republicans wouldn't vote for it, make all the Democrats vote for it, stick it on their record. Are you going to do it to them this time around?
I don't know what will happen. I mean, of course, it'd be that temptation, but we actually got it fairly well during the last 5 or 6 years of the Clinton administration. You didn't have to raise the debt limit because his policies created surpluses, not deficits. But yes, in the past we had to. I know during the Reagan administration, the first Bush administration, they had to raise the debt limit several times. As I recall, a number of Democrats voted with the Republicans. But I think it's a case where there's going to have to at least be an effort to reach across the aisle to get those kind of votes this time.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller in on the conversation. Jesse joins us from Ann Arbor in Michigan.
I just had a question about how, you know, Bush mentioned in his campaigning that he didn't really have an agenda, per se, for who he was going to choose if he got a chance for the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, obviously, if he's going to choose someone who he agrees with or whose judgment he agrees with, then he's going to choose someone who's at least right-leaning. If he gets two spots by chance in the Supreme Court, are we to believe that he's going to choose one right-leaning and one left-leaning judge? And if he doesn't, then we've got two right-leaning judges now or justices now in the Supreme Court. And, you know, how is that possible? Because it has to go through the Senate first, am I right? Like, is that policy going to be considered?
You're right. And Senator Leahy, I think Jesse has identified the hornet's nest.
Well, he has. And actually, I wouldn't be surprised if President Bush has three nominees to make. I think that, of course, the Chief Justice's health is now precarious. I hope he recovers. Even though we disagree philosophically, he's a good personal friend, and I sincerely hope he will recover. But when you look at the ages, you know the president's going to be making some appointments. That's going to have to be his decision. I was kind of concerned over the weekend to hear some of the extremely right-wing religious leaders say that they would make the decision. They would tell the White House who they should appoint for the Supreme Court. Well, the president makes a decision of who he wants to nominate. The Senate has to advise and consent on it, though, not advise and rubber stamp. And I note that, for example, during the Clinton administration, the two nominees of President Clinton's, Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg, sailed through because there had been consultation with both Republicans and Democrats. A number of nominations of previous Republican presidents sailed through because there had been consultation with both. It's when there's not consultation. It's when somebody's put in there to make the Supreme Court an arm of either political party, that's when the battles start.
Jesse, thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
Do you see any alarm bells when the president talked about his agenda the other day in terms of, you know, tax reform, Social Security reform?
Well, I think that the, you know, the tax, he says he wants a tax code simplification. I think we all do. But 2 weeks before the election, something the press didn't pick up, the president very quietly signed a 633-page corporate tax bill. It's going to cost $146 billion over the next 10 years. It gives every kind of special break you could think of, from racetracks to makers of ceiling fans. And it seems... seems kind of crazy to do that and say we want tax reform. We have on Social Security, what if we're going to have privatization, which seems to be what the president wants. He talked about that during his campaign. He didn't say how we'd pay for it. And today, as you know, a lot of the Social Security, what's coming from the taxes, are paying for retirees. If you start privatizing, that money's not there. Are we going to be able to maintain the current level of payments to retirees? And I think my recommendation to the president, if he does want to make these kind of changes, right now every proposal made would end up, I think, eventually putting a Social Security fund in enormous financial distress. What I'd suggest he do is something like former Senator Dole and former Senator Moynihan, one Republican, one Democrat, who came together to try to find ways out of what was then a crisis in the Social Security. I would urge the president to put together a panel of well-respected Republicans and Democrats. They may come back with recommendations a lot different than the sloganeering you hear on a campaign. But most times, sloganeering in a campaign isn't what helps us. Maybe they could come up with a plan that we really would help with Social Security. Otherwise, with the huge deficits we have now, you're going to find it going bankrupt.
As you look at the issues that the president has pointed up, and obviously the issues that the Democrats are interested in, as you look ahead, well, there was the lesson from the first term of education reform, the No Child Left Behind Act. Now, a lot of sniping since it was passed, but nevertheless, Democrats and Republicans were able to work together to get that approved. Do you see any issues right now? Intelligence reform, that sort of thing, where there's a natural bipartisan interest.
Neil, I think there is, and I should mention the No Child Left Behind. The problem was not in the preamble of it. We all want to have our children do better. I'm a parent and a grandparent. I want my children always to do well. The problem is that as soon as it passed, the administration sort of walked away and didn't put the funding in to pay for it. Now, on the I think a good start has been made on intelligence reform. As you know, the Senate passed a bill fairly overwhelmingly. The House then decided to turn it into kind of a pork barrel catch-all bill, and that's where the rub has occurred. I think that there are very good people in both political parties, in both bodies, who, if the president will work with them, could craft a good national security bill, a good intelligence bill that would make us all safer as Americans, because it's not a case you try to make Republicans safe or Democrats safe. We want to make all Americans safe. And that is something, if the president wants to reach out, that is something where both Republicans and Democrats could work together.
Finally, I want to ask you an email we got from Alex in Oakland, California. I'd like to hear your response to the what he describes as wild accusations against you made by James Dobson this past week. Dobson is a leader of some conservative Christians, and I think the quote was, Patrick Leahy is a God's people hater. He went on from there.
Yeah, he suggested I hate God's people, and I guess suggests I hate God. You know, I was brought up in a faith which I hold dearly, where you're taught to love each other. You're taught to love all of God's children, not to hate them. I don't know what kind of a faith Mr. Dobson is in, but if he thinks that people are going, from my faith, they're going out hating people, then he has a very strange view view of us. As a Catholic, I was taught to love each other, to love all of God's people, no matter what faith they're in, no matter who they are, no matter where they are. And that's been a guiding principle in my life.
Senator Leahy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Patrick,
I appreciate the opportunity.
Democrat Patrick Leahy of Vermont joined us from the Senate Radio and Television Gallery on Capitol Hill. Joining us now also from Capitol Hill is Senator John Cornyn, a Republican of Texas. He, too, as Senator Leahy is a member of the Judiciary Committee. And Senator Cornyn, nice of you to join us again on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much, Neil. Good to be with you.
And I wanted to, guess, begin there on the Judiciary Committee, where that's going to be a very hot-button issue. As you know, your colleague Arlen Specter made some comments over the weekend about that anybody who wanted to overturn Roe v. Wade would have difficulty being confirmed by the Senate. That, in turn, has set off some controversy about whether Mr. Specter ought to be the next chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. What do you think?
Well, I want to talk to Senator Specter and find out what his intentions are. If he is chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, obviously it's a very important position. He's in a position to call hearings to confirm presidential nominees to the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. And I think as a leader of the Republicans in the Senate on that important committee, I want to make sure that we're all on the same page. And I think subsequent remarks and clarifications that I've heard indicate to me that perhaps his initial remarks either didn't fully represent his view or perhaps were taken out of context.
As Senator Bush said President Bush said last week that he had earned political capital in this election and now intended to spend it. I guess by extension, the Republicans in the Senate could say pretty much the same thing. Your majority was increased from 51 to 55. What issues do you think are most important this next term of the United States Congress?
Well, Neil, you put your finger on one of them, obviously the Supreme Court and federal judicial nominees. This last term, we saw an unprecedented obstruction of the president's judicial nominees to some of the most important circuit court positions around the country. And I think in some small part, Senator Daschle paid the price as the Democratic leader at the ballot box for that unprecedented obstruction of nominees, denying people even an up or down vote who had bipartisan majority support. But clearly, as the president pointed out, he's interested in doing some of those things that in the past people had considered undoable, things like Social Security reform, because, of course, if we do nothing, we know the system will go bankrupt. And I think rather than continuing to put off some of those hard challenges like Social Security reform, reforming our income tax system that has become hopelessly complex and difficult to deal with as an ordinary citizen, I think he's going to be willing to expend some of that political capital to take on some of those very difficult issues.
We're speaking with Senator John Cornyn about the next Congress of the United States. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email we got from Boyd Petrie in, Salt Lake City, Utah. A headline, he says, in USA Today, says Karl Rove will push for a federal constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage. With his mandate, will President Bush be able to get this through?
We came relatively close, but still up short before the election when, of course, we were responding to the action of the Massachusetts Supreme Court that sought to radically redefine the traditional institution of marriage. And while I think some in the United States Senate sort of thought this was a transitory issue that would go away, we saw on November the 2nd 11 states added to the two that had previously passed state constitutional amendments making sure that marriage was an institution defined in traditional terms between a man and a woman. So I think we may well have greater support for that in the Senate than we did before, but obviously it's going to require two-thirds of the vote in the House and the Senate, plus three-quarters of the states to ratify that constitutional amendment. But we may well have the kind of impetus necessary in order to do that after this mandate.
Let me ask you also about energy legislation. The president has called for this. His bill in the last Congress got hung up on any number of issues. Where does that go, and are we going to see increased drilling in the United States?
Well, I certainly hope that we don't put a lot of our natural resources in this country out of bounds, because, frankly, what it means when we impose a moratorium on exploration for gas or oil in the United States, whether it's in Alaska, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where we can, I believe, develop our natural resources in an environmentally responsible way. What it means when we don't develop our own natural resources here in this country is that we become increasingly reliant on imported oil and energy. And I personally support a balanced energy policy that looks at all sources of energy, whether it's nuclear, oil and gas, coal, alternative forms of energy, whether it's solar or wind, to try to make sure that we provide for the needs of our country. We know now what it's like to be totally dependent, or not totally, but disproportionately dependent on imported oil, and how subject we are to fluctuations in the market, which hit all of us in the pocketbook.
Let's take a call. This is Spencer, who joins us on the line from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Yes, hello, Neil. I'd like to thank you for doing what you do. That's really a good thing.
Thank you, Spencer.
My question is, it seems to me that President Bush has been pretty single-minded and in some ways intolerant of those voices that are opposing to his agenda. How is it that the Republicans are actually going to reach across the aisle, as they have the control now of House and Senate, and really speak to those people who do not feel that President Bush has a mandate, or that he narrowly won this margin, if not stealing the last election? How is that going to happen?
Okay, Spencer, they did have control last time, but Senator Cornyn, is it up to the Republicans to reach across the aisle, or is it now the Democrats' opportunity to say, well, seeing what happened in the election, maybe we should reach across the aisle?
Well, it's a two-way street. I mean, the truth is that I don't believe our constituents send us to Washington, D.C. to fight some of these political games and engage in hyper-partisanship. They send us here to get results and to represent their best interests. And it is a two-way street. But I would point out, in response to your caller, we did just have an election where the president won the popular vote by 3.5 million votes, and obviously was resoundingly elected, received a majority that no president had gotten since 1988, since that election. So I think it was a decisive election. We grew the majorities in the House and the Senate. And I think in many ways the Democrats miscalculated the salience of some of these issues, the cultural issues, as well as the support that the American people feel for our troops in the battlefield, and the importance of getting the job done that we've started in Iraq and Afghanistan as part of the global war on terror. So we've had a national referendum on these issues, and clearly we know that the majority, a substantial majority, agree with the president.
Senator Cornyn, I'm afraid we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas. More after the break. This is NPR News.